Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, Jackie Cation here. You're about to listen to The Dork Forest. You know the websites, dorkforest.com, thedorkforest.com. JackieCation.com has the links to everything. Merch, the new album, my other podcast, videos of me doing stand-up. Dorkforest.com has all the notes and the video that you can watch of this show. Traditionally, I tell you to donate to The Dork Forest, but it is November and December. I ask that you donate to a local food bank because you should. You should do it all year, but what the heck? If you are donating to the Dork Forest using the PayPal link that gives every month, you can turn it off and turn it back on. You can do a matching to your food bank and donate to me as well. But all the money that I get from the donations from November and December, I'll give to my local food bank. And so I will get all of that sweet, sweet karma. Other than that, you can buy merch. You can, for Christmas, there's new t-shirts and stuff. But whatever it is, The Dork Forest, super fun, always available. I'm sure there's things I'm forgetting to say, probably Bandcamp, but let's get into the show. Hey, Jackie Cation, I'm in my garage. It's happening already, Vish. It's happening already.
Already doing it? This is amazing. It's so fast.
It's so fast. I just did your podcast. It's Vish Khanna, by the way, I'm talking with. And the name of your podcast was Creative Control.
Still is. It hasn't gone anywhere. You said was. It's not.
Yeah, present tense. We're not doing it. And you're like, I wish I'd take a shower. And I was like, you look like your dorkdom. You look like that rugged Bob Dylan.
Yeah, that's true.
You got that vibe going. It's nice.
I do have that. Yeah, it's true. You're right.
Thank you for the compliment.
I was feeling self-conscious. Now I feel good.
Now you feel good because it's a good looking Bob Dylan, because that dude absolutely always kind of a goony looking dude. But I don't know anything about Bob Dylan, by the way, except for that he was a Rolling Stone? He was not in the Rolling Stones.
No, he was not. He had a song called Like a Rolling Stone.
That was it.
You literally know nothing about Bob Dylan. You know nothing.
I know that my brother Phil really likes him.
Now, I know some of your brothers seem cool, and at least one of them, based on our conversation, one of them I might not jive with. Is Phil a cool brother?
Oh, Phil's the cool brother. He's been on the Dork Forest twice. He has talked about hitchhiking, which he also talked about Lord of the Rings.
Oh.
So those were his two dorkdoms. Yeah.
Lord of the Rings is basically an epic hitchhiking tale, isn't it?
I mean, it really is.
That's all they're doing.
Truly, truly an epic hitchhiking tale that he is. Right. He couldn't be more interested. He wants to come back on and talk about fly fishing. My brother Russ has been on talking about the Hallmark Channel. My sister Darla has been on talking about preparing quick meals. She enjoys fancy meals done quickly.
That's who doesn't? I mean, isn't that what fast food is? I mean, when you think about it, one of the sandwiches is pretty elaborate. It's got three buns. Two patties.
Oh, if you were I remember to do that one.
Properly, yeah, it would probably take you, 45 minutes. And here we live in a society where you get it in 3 minutes.
It's true. It's just out and it's been nuked into a gray color that who doesn't want any part of that?
Absolutely. That's the way it works. Yes.
What do you know about Bob Dylan?
Whew. Well, you can't see them, but to my left.
Yep.
We're on a video chat thing here. I have every single Bob Dylan record and box set.
Oh,
all of them are here.
Is there redundancy?
No, not in the Bob Dylan realm.
For instance, I
have four Beatles box sets that are ostensibly the same. I have the mono box set and then I have the stereo box set.
Ah.
And I have them in both CD and vinyl formats. So you're not wrong to ask.
This is a valid question, is what you're telling me.
There's duplication in the sense that they'll put out a bootleg series, Bob Dylan will, I mean, and it'll be kind of an alternate version of an album we've all come to know and love. But I mean, it's really alternate. It's like outtakes, and like the original album might be 12 songs. The bootleg series will be like 80 songs. So it's not really, it's like a whole other universe.
Right.
So yeah, I have everything. And then again, everything on CD. With Dylan, mm-hmm. I found out about Bob Dylan when I was a little boy because I would read a lot about the Beatles.
And oh, okay.
Every once, Yeah, so my gateway to music was really my cousin Anand got me into it. He played me like a Beatles compilation.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, what? And he played me like The Police and Love and Rockets, like early 80s. U2 got me obsessed with U2. But the Beatles really was the first thing I remember being obsessed with. And so from a, like, I'm talking like 6, 7 years old, just like obsessed with them. And then I would read every, I was a voracious reader, read every book I could get my hands on. There was a really, you know, as we're speaking, Jackie, everyone's going off about this Get Back documentary about the Beatles.
There right. I've heard of that. Yeah.
You've heard of it. It's a little ubiquitous, I would think. But
yeah, it's hard not to. It. Yeah.
There was a documentary about the Beatles that aired on PBS called The Complete Beatles. And Pleat was spelled like E-A-T. So it was a little pun.
Oh, anyway, there you go. Yeah.
My dad bought us a VCR. And I could record things. I was like born to be a media person. So I just would record everything I liked. I figured out how to do it. In fact, I taught them how to use it. I don't know what that, but I was very young. And so I recorded that Beatles documentary, became obsessed with them. Anyway, as you're reading about the Beatles, eventually you get to the point where they met Bob Dylan and started getting hot. And
was he their drug dealer? Was he like the gateway drug guy?
Ostensibly, in terms of the marijuana.
The marijuana?
Apparently, yes. I'm sure they were taking amphetamines to play their like 12-hour concerts in Berlin when they were like 20 years old or whatever it was. But anyway, he introduced them to, he thought that this, when they said, what's the song? It's called She Loves You, right? Is that the Beatles song called She Loves You?
Sure.
And they say, he thought they were saying, they were saying, I can't hide. Like, you've got to love, I can't hide. He heard, I get high, and assumed they were hip to the whole scene, man. But instead, and they were like, what is this wacky smoking? Kind of Dylan was their gateway into lots of stuff. And they loved his songwriting and music and all that stuff. Anyway, so I started, I went to the local library and I got a Bob Dylan Greatest Hits album.
Okay.
And I thought that was the first one. There's a few different Greatest Hits records with that guy.
Is it the blue one? Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the one I think my stepmother had that one.
Yeah. It's got like his silhouette of his head.
Yeah. Of his head. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. So that was my sort of, I should say the Beastie Boys. I also like the Beastie Boys, and they would sample and talk about Bob Dylan on their records. So Bob Dylan, everyone was Bob Dylan, right?
Right.
So I get the greatest hits thing when I'm, I don't know, 12, 13, whatever it was.
Sure.
I like it. I dubbed it from the library. I taped it.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, you held a tape player up to the album, the record player?
No. Okay. You know what? I give my parents, my dad in particular, credit. He had all the stuff. We had like 2 VCRs at one point. We could dub stuff.
You could dub stuff. Yeah. All right. So you did it for reals. Okay.
Yeah, so I think I took out a tape or a CD and I dubbed the whole thing and then made myself a tape.
Yeah.
Of the Greatest Hits thing. But it wasn't really till university era for me, mm-hmm, where I went to a used record store in Kitchener, or rather a record store in Kitchener called Encore Records. Give them a little plug.
Sure.
And they had used stuff, and I was going through the Dylan stuff. This is like 97, I want to say.
Okay.
So I'm going through the, what else had happened, by the way? I'm all over the place, but that's the way it is with Bob Dylan. In 1997, he puts out a record called Time Out of Mind, and I go to the university newspaper at the University of Guelph office, and they say, hey, take what you want. We need record reviews. So I take Time Out of Mind out, and hang on, let me see if I can grab it. I'm all synced up here. But if you get here, this is what Time Out of Mind looks like, Jackie.
Okay.
So if you look at it, there's Bob Dylan. He's looking kind of older, right?
Yep. Yep.
Can you see that? Yeah.
Yep. He's but in the middle.
But on the back.
He's a baby.
He looks younger. I think it's the same era, but he looks a lot younger. So I was confused by this release. I didn't know what it was, but it was in the new section. I thought, is this another Greatest Hits thing? But I took it home and I loved it. And this, by the way, stands as my favorite. 97. My
97.
Favorite.
Time Out of Mind. What's on that one?
So this is the one he won the Grammy for. In terms of like hits, here's songs I sing to my daughter.
Okay.
And my son every night. I play guitar and I sing these two songs in particular. I sing Make You Feel My Love, which was in the last 10 years exploded because Adele covered it.
Okay.
Made it a bigger song than it was. This came out kind of quiet in 97.
Right.
And so I sing that one to my daughter. And it's one of those songs where I don't know if you have any regrets about your wedding, but
Yeah, what, just one. And then so we didn't record who the speakers.
Oh, that is,
oh, you're talking about okay. A different kind of regret.
No, I thought that's where you're going. I have one major regret about my wedding day and the decision I made. No. I regret not singing. I had like my family was from all over the world, really was there.
Right.
And I dabble in music, and the band that I was in at the time became this like wedding band. That we formed.
And they played.
They played, but I didn't. I didn't perform. Someone else played drums. Someone else sang songs, and did all sorts of things.
You were getting married, Feach.
I was pretty busy. Yeah, so
you were busy that day.
I regret not singing some songs to my wife in front of my family, who might have thought that was a nice thing.
That it was sweet. Yeah, yeah.
I say this with all humility. I didn't think anyone really wanted me to sing anything because I can't do it really. But I say to you, I regret it. And this song, Make You Feel My Love, would be a very nice and sweet song to sing on your wedding day for anyone listening who's like, what should I play music? What should I do? Great song. And then the other one I sing to my daughter, which is very long, Standing in the Doorway. That's a lovely song, very heartbreaky. This record is very swampy, I guess you would say. And anyway, it got to
me. What does that mean, swampy?
The ambiance of the recording is like a part of the character. It's not just great songs, but the people who made the record with Dylan, notably Mark Howard, the engineer, and Daniel Lanois, who produced it, went after kind of a gauzy sound, like a thick sound. Remember when you were on my show and I was telling you about the thick North Carolina air? Do you remember this? We were talking about North Carolina. I was like, oh, the air is sweet. You can almost taste it. This record has the same feeling. You put it on and you're kind of, it's got a hum to it. It's got like an ambiance to it. So that really helps. Just sort of, it creates a mood. I remember I put it on once when I was driving with my band many years, like 2003 or something, four or five, something like that.
Sure.
And the singer in the band had never heard it. And we were pulling an all-nighter, and he just was like, this is, it felt like a midnight to 8 a.m. kind of record.
Okay.
Like very late night. Anyway, get this thing from the school newspaper, and I put it on. I'm like, oh, this is a new record, I guess. These aren't hits,
right.
Even though he looks young on the back. And I fall in love with it. So then, back to my story about going to the record store in Kitchener, I got a little fever now. So then I go to the record store, and I'm going through the used CDs, and there's a copy of John Wesley Harding, which came out in 68, 69 era there. And
isn't that a murderer? Who's John Wesley?
John Wesley Harding. Sorry, it came out in 67. He might have been a murderer. He's a mythic folk character, sure.
Okay.
I think there's also a modern day singer who goes by John Wesley Harding, actually.
Oh, wow. All right.
Yeah. So anyway, that record also opened a whole universe to me about Dylan that I didn't recognize. Because I had the greatest hits. I knew of him. I knew he collaborated. I'm a big U2 fan still when I was a kid. He was on Rattle and Hum, co-wrote a song with Bono and The Edge.
Okay.
And yeah, anyway, so he was peripheral, but then I got that John Wesley Harding record and the band sound. This record, Jackie, so you know, is considered like a harbinger of folk rock. Really like, oh, this is, it's not just folk. It's not just, you know.
And this is 67. This is 1967.
I'm just making stuff up as I go, and I hope expert.
It's, yeah. You don't have to be an expert. I like the enthusiasm. I like the articulation.
For years, I thought it was 68, but I recently, and I don't, my internet's all off here, or I'd look it up. But I in recent years, you know, sometimes you just have it fixed in your head that something's one thing, and then you read one thing, a different thing, and you're like, oh, the thing I've been thinking for 20 years is a year, I'm a year off. So it's technically 67. I always thought it was 68. John Wesley Harding, another gateway into, whoa, this is more than the greatest hits guy.
This is
a guy that I got to explore all in. Then I just got all in. I first saw him in Toronto in the year 2000 at the what was then called the Molson Amphitheater, and then I was obsessed already. So I
was it a big venue?
Yeah, that's an outdoor amphitheater. So it's one of those. It was
like
outside.
70,000-80,000 kind of sports.
No. This is like probably 15 to 25,000, maybe.
Okay, so big, but
it was
not
huge. Yeah, it was big. Yeah.
Sort of like an outdoor. Is it like grassy?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you got the stage, and then you got maybe like a pit area. Yeah. Then you got rows and rows of seats, and then you have like a grassy embankment for the cheap people, the cheap seats, if you will.
Right, right. Yeah.
And so I, that was the show I saw. And then I subsequently have seen him like 40 times.
Oh my God. I saw since 2000? That's like twice a year.
Here's a, here, I'll grab this if I can get it off the wall. This is a poster. It's not coming off. Oh, there we go.
Are you in a hotel room? You know how they always nail them. That is in show and concert, the Newman Outdoor Field, Bob Dylan.
Fargo, North Dakota.
And Fargo, North Dakota. Oh, are you? Wow. Guess what's happening? My gardener is here. It's a Monday. What's he doing? And when I say gardener, I mean guy who cuts my lawn and blows leaves around my yard.
I'm just trying to prove to you that in the year 2001,
yep,
I saw Bob Dylan a lot of times. So I saw him in Toronto in November.
Okay.
That was the second time. And then I saw him in on August 16th, 2002, which was the 25th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death,
right.
I want to say. I think that's correct. And in my master's thesis, which I handed in that day, which was about Bob Dylan's 2001 album, which came out on 9/11. Never forget that great record. Came out on Love and Theft came out on 9/11. That's very poor taste, I understand, but I can't help it.
It's decades later. It's
fine. It came out on, what are the odds that one of his greatest records came out on such a horrible, horrible day? But yeah.
Does he have any bad albums?
Well,
we don't need to talk about it, but I mean, like,
no, I think there's virtue in all of them. And that recently occurred to me because I reviewed for a magazine this latest bootleg series collection, which focused on his 80s, which are commonly thought of as a pretty rough period for artists, not just for Dylan, but like Neil Young had a bad 80s. Only iconic person who seemed to have a good 80s was Bruce Springsteen.
Okay.
And of course, Madonna and Prince. But I mean, of the 60s,
of the 60s and 70s dudes.
Iconic era. Yeah. 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 I guess George Harrison also had a pretty good 80s because he kind of came back out of nowhere. But anyway, my point is this. Yeah, he has some dodgy records by his own admission. But
one of the best ones came out on 9/11, 2001. September 11th, 2001.
It's called Love and Theft. And I just started my 1 year master's degree in English at the University of Guelph. And they tell you got to write a big paper.
Yep.
So I ended up, I was like, what should I do? I don't know what to do. I was wrestling. I noticed there were some allusions to Shakespearean plays on Love and Theft. And I thought, oh, that would be really Englishy.
That is a stretch. And I love that reach. Well played.
But then what happened was I really dug into the record. And as I did more research, I realized it could be the whole record could be the focus of a paper. So that ended up being my year. And then, as I say, I got to hand it in. My degree was like September to September, basically. Like September to August was the nature of the degree. So on August 16th, 2002, hand in my thesis about Love and Theft. Go see Bob Dylan, play songs from the record. And he plays Tweedledee and Tweedledum, which I argued might be about Elvis and his dead twin brother.
Okay.
Because Elvis was a twin.
I did not know that.
Elvis Presley was a twin, but his brother passed.
Did he make it out into the...
No, he didn't make it.
Did he make it out of the womb, or...
You know, I wasn't there that day. I don't know the full medical details. I'd have to look it up on Wikipedia. I feel like he did not survive that aspect.
The birth. He was not born. Okay, fair enough.
That's right. I believe if you end up ever at Graceland, there might actually be, beside Elvis's gravesite, I feel like the lost brother.
I actually was at Graceland and I saw his grave, but did not notice any other grave.
It could be I'm making that part up. I can't remember, but I feel like there was some commemoration of this fact.
Fair enough.
In the Elvis camp.
But Tweedledee anyway, and Tweedledum?
Yeah, that's the song. Hopefully I got the title right. I feel like I'm just winging it here and I'm getting everything wrong and all the Dylan people are going to be mad at me, but that's what happens when you're riffing. But
they're going to love it.
He did that song that night. And then I was scheduled. So I saw him in Toronto on August 16th. And then I was scheduled to go visit my friend in Saskatchewan. And we'd had a ticket, I think, to one of the, he was, so Dylan was doing like a cross country tour, but he was also dipping into the States to play places like Fargo. And so we had, my friend and I had tickets to the shows in Saskatchewan. I think it was Saskatoon was the only show. And then we made a plan as a road trip to go see him in Fargo, which we were stopped at the border by the border from Saskatchewan to whatever the state is below it. What would it be? I don't know. I don't get the geography, but it's like probably Montana or something.
Sure.
I don't remember. But the border guard was all like, oh, going to see Bob Dylan, eh? So got anything in your car you want us to know about? And I was like, I don't do drugs. I don't do any drugs at all. I don't drink. I don't do anything like that.
Not right.
But my friend was a tennis at the time. He's now a lawyer, but he was a tennis instructor. So his trunk was full. We left from like a tennis camp thing he was doing in Regina, Saskatchewan, right to go to Fargo. Cause it's just
right.
So the guy's inspecting the car and making all these like innuendos about drugs. And I don't know all the names. What is one of the names? Is it THC or something? Is that what you call
that, yeah, I think that that's the active ingredient in marijuana. Yes.
So I'm going to see Bob Dylan. I don't know anything about marijuana, which, you know, I'm just like, he's like making references to that. And I'm like, I don't know what that, what does that stand for? And my buddy's like, it's, dude, it's pot. Like, shut up.
Yeah.
Anyway, he opens a trunk full of tennis balls and tennis rackets. Like, I don't know what he thought we were doing. Just rammed full of balls and rackets and, he must have thought we were odd. But anyway, he let us go.
I don't know why I thought it was going to be full of cats. Because a cat got, I don't know. It was like, he was a tennis guy.
Yeah,
anyway.
He's a tennis guy. So we go down to Fargo and I go to the Blockbuster at the Fargo and I say,
you know, hey, a party.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're in a plaza. There's not much to do. We're very early for the show. So I had actually playing tennis at a tennis court near the venue in Fargo, because we had a lot of equipment with us. I decided we were in a plaza. I'm like, you know, it'd be funny, maybe go to the Blockbuster Video, ask people what they think of the movie Fargo. Man, this was not a, well,
no, it's not a great idea. The people in Fargo were angry. They were angry.
That's exactly, I can tell you that my reporting that
they were not fans.
The clerk was like, just so you, okay, yeah, we get this all the time, ha ha ha, just so you know, like the action of the movie doesn't even take place in Fargo. They just call it, they meet in Fargo. They have nothing to do
with
it.
They're in Bemidji, they're in Moorhead, they're just, they're not in Fargo, they're up in the Iron Range. It doesn't make any sense. Why would they even call it Fargo?
I just remember that being notable about the trip as I did that. And then so anyway, then we go see the show, and Bob Dylan and his band are playing in a Little League baseball diamond field.
Ooh.
Now, he would subsequently do, he liked, I think that was the first one that he did in that era, but he subsequently liked it so much. They were, so Bob Dylan and his band, they come across as like loners from out of town, cowboys. They carry themselves with a certain gravitas.
Yes.
They don't say a lot of stuff. They're very stoic. And his band at the time was one of the best bands I'd ever seen. But they were so, and so I'd seen him a bunch and had noticed the stoicism and the seriousness. Dylan rarely even says anything except to introduce the band members in Fargo. And I vividly remember this, giggling on stage.
Because he thought it was so funny.
I think he
and super fun.
It was super fun to play in a Little League diamond for him.
Here's my question. Is he playing on home plate and the audience is sitting like shortstop?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we're I think that's correct. I think they're on home plate. We're all, as you can imagine, a diamond goes out like this. So we're all assembled. Yeah. So there is a great show. And then my friend, I tell him when I get there, like, just so you know, with Dylan or people like Dylan, we might want to go to more than just the shows we have planned. And he's like, get out of here. What are you talking about? We're not going to go to Calgary and Edmonton and these other shows. I'm like, okay, he gets the fever. So we go from Fargo or wherever. I can't remember the order, but I think we went from Fargo, followed him to Alberta, bought seats from the people on the street.
Like the Grateful Dead. Like you just followed Bob Dylan. Well, I mean, that is the iconic one. That is the one that everybody talks about.
Yes.
But in this case, it's 2004 and you're following Bob Dylan around.
2002. It's a fall of 2002. So we're following Bob Dylan. And then this became a habit for me. So like I don't mean to invoke a drug habit, but like it gets addictive because the shows I think are fantastic. They're unpredictable. He does songs in whatever mood strikes him. Like the arrangements as the tour goes on or they get going, but they don't sound like the records, which people find really difficult to deal with. They don't like it.
Right. People like to sing along.
Yeah.
Which is weird because in stand-up comedy, they want to hear different jokes. But in music, they want to hear the album for some reason. Yeah.
Yeah. I've never bought it. There was a trend the last 15 years. And I don't know when the record industry started dying and people, the story was that people weren't buying records anymore.
Right.
And then I noticed a trend where the artists would say, hey, come see us. We're going to play your favorite album front to back in order. And to me, as an avid concert goer, I'm like, why did you just ruin the entire experience of going to a show, which is based on being surprised by what the artist does? Maybe they take a song in a different direction. Now they're not only saying we're going to try to play the album, the songs faithfully to the studio version, we're going to play them in order. So yeah. Instead of, which I found distracting when I would see Bruce Springsteen or someone say, we're going to do The River in order. I'd be like, okay, well, the next song, he'd start a song. I'd be like, okay, well, I know the next song is Sherry Darling. So, okay, I know what the next song is. Like, I just, the whole point I thought of going to see a show
right,
was to be surprised.
And, right, right. There should be something different about a live experience than a recorded one. That is interesting. Did other people like it though? Were they psyched that he was doing that or they were doing that?
Well, so Dylan doesn't do that. Just so we clarify that part, he would never do that. His songs change sometimes 5 shows in, the arrangement might change completely. And he just goes where Dylan has a philosophy that I really abide by, which is the record, the recording session is just that day. That's what happened. That's what happened those days. We were in there. But the song can be anything. And some people have a hard time with that. I've seen him at
the, I kind of love that attitude.
This is what I love about him. So it's not simply that I think he is arguably the most influential and important musical artist of these times. Like when people say, why do you go see him so much? I'm like, well, if you knew William Shakespeare was touring through the world, you probably would be like, I mean, he's not an actor. This is a bad example. But if you knew someone was kind of doing something and they were significant,
right?
You know, if Gandhi came to your town, you'd probably go see Gandhi. I don't know how much touring Gandhi did. I don't think he did much. I think he was on foot.
He was working the road. I think most of his life.
Well, looming wasn't that portable back then. You had to be stationary at the loom, I think is how that worked at the time. But I have to Wikipedia this to confirm. But my point is, he is circulating in our time. I'm going to go see him.
Right, right. He is still alive.
He's still, he just turned, I'm insulted. No, I'm kidding. he turned 80 this past May as we're speaking.
Okay.
And was off the road because of the pandemic for the longest time in like his life, other than when he actually took deliberate breaks in the 60s and the 70s, I should say. But since like the 80s, he's just been touring, I don't know, 200,
kind of 300. Nonstop?
Nonstop. Yeah. So this is why I've seen him so much, and I've seen him in Detroit and Fargo and across Canada and also across Ontario, which I don't live in anymore.
Right.
But anyway, he did just recently do, we're not post-COVID, we're not post-pandemic, but he is among the people that took the risk of going out and doing about...
We're post-lockdown is what we really are.
That's right. Yeah. So he did, just like you, you've been touring as well. So people are doing it and it's making me upset because I want to see them. And
but also don't want to get a breakthrough.
I don't want to get a breakthrough with I have children and they're just now they got their first vaccines here in Canada. So hopefully they're, and then we've got the variants and I don't want it. I'm not ready yet to go get it myself. It seems to be impacting people, even if you're whatever.
So if you're vaccinated, it's there. You could get super sick. So I'm boosted and stuff. So which has made me not cocky still, but I was in Florida this last like 4 days ago. And I don't know if you know what happened in Florida, but clearly COVID did not. Cause there aren't any, there's very few masks. There's no mask mandate. I mean, it's a pile of dum-dums. So
it's a leadership thing. You got that. Is it Ron DeSantis? Is that the guy down there?
That's him. That's it. Yeah. It is trouble from the top down.
Yeah.
So if you could fix the top, there will be some help. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Haven't been to see him in two years.
He was playing that's right. And he's been playing the United States. He hasn't come up here to Canada. If he did, he probably would come to Ontario. And I always thought when we moved in late 2019, well, if Dylan's playing, I'll probably try to make a trip of it, you know, if he's doing a bunch of shows. But I almost, yeah, I talked to some people on my show who were like, I haven't talked to anyone who's gone, but they were going and they've okay. since gone. So I should check in with them. But people are posting clips. Dylan quit smoking in the last couple of years, few years. He's been off the road. The clips tell the tale. His singing is fantastic. He's hitting notes. It's great. I always like his people get mad or upset about his singing voice in his later years. But I think so. The thing is with Dylan, I'm a punk. I come from punk rock. And okay. I think Dylan is a punk rocker. When I talk about the fact that he's like, the recording's just the day, man.
Yeah.
Whatever the song wants to be, it wants to be. That's an element of relaxation and looseness and borderline nihilism that I can appreciate. And when he attacks the songs, he's got this growl to it where he's kind of matured into the kind of blues singer that inspired him when he was a kid.
Or right.
In the 40s and 50s. And so he's become, to me, this beautiful singer. Like, I think it's very earthy and significant. People can be like, oh, his voice is gone and all that stuff. And I think there have been times where his voice has been labored, but.
Well, did he, isn't he famous for never having really a great voice?
Well, that's what people say, but I think he's also
so
famous
changed.
For having.
Yeah.
Well, he's famous. Like, I talked about John Wesley Harding and the next record, Nashville Skyline, which I don't know if you know it, but it's got Lay Lady Lay on it.
Okay.
And his duet with Johnny Cash.
Yep.
Yeah. And if you listen to his voice there, if you're familiar with like a Rolling Stone or any other era, but if you listen to what he did to himself, like he sweetened his voice willfully.
Okay.
In 1969. And then he sang like that for maybe the next collection of songs, which is sort of a kind of a compilation called Self Portrait that came out in the 70, 71 kind of thing. But he just willfully changed his voice. And he's got these eras. So you become a little obsessed with someone when they're the same the whole time, just
sure.
consistently great. You know, I think Neil Young is someone whose voice has kind of mostly been the same. Like if he sang a song from 1971, he could pretty much pull it off.
Okay.
But Dylan, I think in the same mindset as the song is whatever it wants to be, and I'm there for it, and I'm going to follow whatever muse I have in that moment. His voice has also just changed. And I think it's been interesting. The 80s, I think, is an era that people have the most trouble with. It's the one I think comedians and impressionists are. That's what they're
right, right. Yeah, that's what they make fun of, which is where I get a lot of my Dylan information. It isn't okay.
Yes.
But the thing is, like, I get most of my information about Adele from comedy.
Yeah.
So, so he grew up in the 30s and 40s loving blues, loving sort of a bluesy, jazzy kind of thing.
He was born in 41 and got into rock and roll music. Buddy Holly, he got to see Buddy Holly, I think a week or two before Buddy Holly passed away in that horrible plane crash.
Right, right.
So rock and roll really spoke to him. I just finished this book. I'm sorry, I have lots of visual aids.
That's good. This will be on YouTube.
Is this going to be on YouTube?
Yeah, it'll be on YouTube.
I just read this book by Clinton Halen. Clinton Halen is a Dylanologist, what people call him.
Right.
The only Dylanologist worth reading, New York Times. That's what
All
he says.
All right. The Dylanologist, as opposed to like a biographyist or
yeah,
whatever the word biography would be if it were used as an adjective.
It's a bit of a loaded term. There was a fellow in the 60s and 70s who had harassed Dylan in the name of journalism, going through his trash and all this stuff. And then Dylanology is kind of a loaded term. Us Dylan fans, some of us like it, or some of us are fine with it, I should say. Some of us are like, what are you so obsessed with? Like, I'm on the show with you to talk about my obsession with him, but I'm also like, I'm a normal person. I'm not going to go.
Right. You're not going to follow him around. You're not going to tackle him if you see him.
No. If that's right. If I encountered him, I think I'd say, how are you? I don't think I'd be like,
you
great,
might say, I enjoy your work.
Yes.
When I first met Walter Koenig, I was so intimidated because of my love of Star Trek that when I shook his hand, I looked deeply into his eyes, which he slid away from real quick, eye contact wise.
Yeah.
And I said, I really like your work. And he said, great.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. That was intense enough, but yeah, the Dork Force, safe space to get to love. Yeah.
I think it can open up the can of worms where, if someone like me was in the wrong space, I'd see Bob Dylan. I'd say, "Hey, you're Bob Dylan. In 1966, you said blah, blah, blah. What did that mean?" And then he'd be like, "Dude, what are you talking about? Like, I'm not that."
You're not that guy. You admire the living in the moment thing.
Yes, I do. So I think there's lots of great mysteries and things that you could unravel about him and his work, but I don't fixate. I was thinking about it. It's almost maybe to my detriment because I consider myself a Dylan fan, as you can tell, like a huge fan.
Very much so.
But there's aspects of his nuances that I don't know. When people are like, use certain shorthand, I'm like, oh, this is a whole dark web of Dylan knowledge that I just don't really know or have.
And you don't feel like you need to know to some extent.
Yeah, there's certain respect for him in that regard. And also recognizing that he's so playful and is, I think, you know, he's from the 60s. You should go watch like his press conferences in the 60s because he's got the press figured out. He's got perception figured out early. He realizes you can mess with people a little bit because the questions are so, it's like a post-game interview with an athlete. So you scored 50 points and you beat the other team. What was that like? These are the kinds of questions that musicians would get. Like you played an A chord. Why? Well, how am I supposed to answer that? So you watch those press conferences. He's very funny. He's very sharp. And he likes to kind of mess with people a little bit. Oh, Jackie. Okay. There was a thing that came out in the last couple of years. Martin Scorsese and Dylan made a kind of documentary that's sort of a faux documentary about the Rolling Thunder Review Tour. It's on Netflix.
Okay.
Watch it because you should watch it and know that almost 60% of it is made up. But presented.
Really?
Yeah. They just made stuff up, made up characters, made up people. Sharon Stone's in it pretending that she encountered Dylan in the 70s. Like a whole thing. I don't want to spoil anything.
Right.
Fantastic sense of humor. Like, so my thing is, I've seen Dylan make jokes on stage. I love the wit about him.
Right.
I think he has fun with the fact that people take him so seriously. So,
right. Because he's literally, in my mind, he's some sort of icon of justice and sort of philosophy. I mean, he's like our American philosopher.
Yes.
And so to hear that he's also kind of silly. It's just smart, silly. Yeah. I like playing in a little league. This is hilarious. I'm having the time of my life.
Yeah. No, he has a lot of fun, but he presents himself as very hard. And I think like if you see
and
photos
grizzled.
Of him, yes. Yeah. He can be grizzled. He's mostly pretty clean shaven. I don't know why you're so obsessed with the grizzling, but he's not that I'm grizzled. He's not that grizzled, but anyway, yeah, he's always sort of like trying to humanize himself, but also escape every pigeonhole. Every time he does anything, there's some element of pigeonholing him in the reception.
Because people are like, what are some of the pigeonholes besides philosopher and grizzled, which are the two that I seem to have?
Well, I think people think he's up to something a lot of the time. But I will give them credit. He does seem to be up to something a lot of the time. Like, not just like putting out a record, he'll do a thing where he'll agree to a Victoria's Secret campaign. And people are like, what the hell? Why is Bob Dylan and his song?
Did he sell out? Did he sell out?
Album? Yeah.
From that very album. It's Victoria's Secret.
Yeah, Victoria's Secret, Love Sick. The song is used in the ad and he appears kind of like a weird, like phantom, you know, really playing on the kind of notion that he's this living specter. Like, I think he really enjoys being ghostly and weird. And I think he knows that all he has to do is stuff like that. And people start talking about him. I'm not saying he's attention starved per se, but it's kind of fascinating how easily it is to get people chatting about you. And I think he figured that out early and thought he would have fun with it. And I think that's what punk is too. Like, I think they may not cop to it, but when I think about prototypical punk, interviews Lou Reed and Iggy Pop did, like, really,
well, they still have to fill the room.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not, I just think he's endlessly fascinating and I don't know what it is. I think about him every day and he's still, I think it also helps that unlike some of his contemporaries, his records are all great. Like, he continuously makes fantastic, great records. They sound like nothing else. Like, he has moved into this weird realm of, I don't know what you would call it. Like, he was doing kind of blues rocky stuff, and then it got kind of big band jazz swingy. Now okay. It's some amalgam of last few times I saw him, like songs from a 2012 album sounded like post-punk songs. And like, so always has these killer players with him. And he's just he's 80. I imagine right. He's not so with it in terms of like trends and stuff like that. But then when you go see him,
yeah,
you get the sense that he kind of is. He kind of knows how to present his stuff so that it comes across kind of timeless and weird. So that's where I'm coming from. I just think he's fascinating.
Right. Does he, now here's literally one of the only, I loved this song when I was a child. It's the only song I could think of. It's Blowing in the Wind.
Yes.
And I loved it. I would cry when I would sing it when I was, because we had music class. This is the 12th century, you guys. They used to have music classes in public school when I was.
My kids have music classes.
You live in Canada.
Yeah, that's true. Right. Yeah, that's right.
The United States has decided to get rid of anything artistic.
Yeah, that's true.
My music teacher, when I was in fifth grade, dressed like a dragonfly. It was 1975. She was wearing a lot of diaphanous, wavy kind of.
I see.
She was amazing. We sang Puff the Magic Dragon and Blowing in the Wind. And literally just kids, just tears streaming down their face while they cried Puff the Magic Dragon while they sang it. It was awesome. it was, when I look back on it, it's kind of epic. But so here's what I don't know. And I'm almost certain that Bob Dylan writes his own lyrics and music.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. And he plays the guitar
and piano and harmonica. And so I noticed it, and I don't know if anyone else has really talked about it, but when the musician Warren Zevon,
okay,
in like 2001 or two announced he was terminally ill with cancer, Warren famously played piano, and I noticed that Dylan shifted away from guitar completely to start playing piano and keyboards, which he has continued to do basically ever since. And that was coupled with the fact that he began to cover some of Warren's music.
In
the show. So he would switch to piano. As far as I can recall, he just switched to piano completely for his own songs, because he composes a lot of his songs on piano.
Okay.
Dylan does. Has since the 60s, not simply guitars. And if you go see him live now, you'll see he generally has a keyboard set up. It got so interesting to the point that people have speculated he could no longer play guitar.
Oh, weird.
Arthritis or something. But then every once in a while, he would play guitar. I once saw him do a song. I think it was I'll Be Your Baby Tonight in, I want to say it was London, Ontario.
Okay.
And I've never really seen him do this before. He sang the song and soloed the whole time while he was singing. Normally a guitar player who's singing would say, hey, you other three guitar players, one of you play rhythm and the other two, wank around, just play some solos, do some stuff. He was just singing and soloing the whole time. And I've never seen him do that before or since. And so he could play. He can play guitar, and he does on the latest record, Rough and Rowdy Ways, that came out in 2020. Anyway, yeah, he composes a lot on piano. I'm sorry. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, you did. Yeah. But my follow-up question to that is, does he do a lot of covers live?
Yes, it depends. Around that same time, George Harrison passed away. And so he did Something, I want to say, the song Something by the Beatles that George wrote. He did the Warren Zevon thing. I saw him play two shows.
Right.
In Detroit in, I want to say it was like 2006, let's say. Could be wrong, but no, it was maybe 04. I saw him do two shows. He was doing three shows at a venue in Detroit. And I went the first night. And that day, the governor declared it in Michigan, Bob Seger Day. So Dylan did a Bob Seger song in the encore, and everyone went nuts.
Right.
Again, I don't think him and his band had done it before or since. They just did it that night. And then the next night, my wife happened to be, her sales job brought her to Detroit. So we agreed we would go we got to meet up and see the second show. And I says to my wife, I says, you know what's going to happen here tonight? I bet that either Jack White of the White Stripes or Eminem will join Bob Dylan tonight. And I was sort of joking. We were in Detroit. That's where those guys are from.
Yeah, those guys live there.
I'd seen the White Stripes do Dylan songs live. I knew Jack White loved him.
Mm-hmm.
So the second night's rolling along. Great show. Encore. Who steps out on the stage? Jack White. What song do they do of Dylan's? None. They do a White Stripes song. Dylan is singing the song Ball and Biscuit by the White Stripes with Jack White playing guitar. I don't even know if Jack sang. I don't think he did. So what are you? You're Jack White. You know, you're probably 20 odd years old.
Right.
Not only are you singing with Bob Dylan, he has chosen to sing one of your songs.
Yeah.
Come on. Like that is, so they have this like close relationship. And,
is there bootlegs of some of this stuff?
I've looked for some of it and I feel like I encountered some shoddy YouTube recording of a Ball and Biscuit. I think there is that on the Bob Dylan site. That Warren Zevon and George Harrison stuff I was alluding to, it might still be up, but at the time, the BobDylan.com site would post live MP3s.
Okay.
Of such things. So I heard them do something, and I heard that. I had that somewhere probably saved.
Yeah, that's super fun.
Yeah, so he has done covers. In fact, prior to this album, Rough and Rowdy Ways, he did... three or four albums devoted to the works that Frank Sinatra would sing.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. So he loves Frank Sinatra. He got to sing at Frank Sinatra's birthday celebration.
Okay.
Frank Sinatra liked Dylan's songs. So he got to sing a Sinatra standard. Sinatra didn't write his own songs generally. Right. So
but
when
just the songs that Sinatra's famous made for
famous,
singing.
Yeah. So Dylan did an amazing
My Way. Song.
So that's just it. He did an amazingly well curated versions of songs that are kind of deeper Sinatra cuts.
Oh, sure.
And sort of adopted a real film noir vibe for them, if you will. Like the videos are all kind of shadowy and dark and really suit the songs. And so I have this weird thing, I'll tell you right now, Jackie. I have like a bizarre connection to Bob Dylan in that I will write reviews or I will ask if I can go to shows, and the Bob Dylan people say, yes, that would be great. Let's get you, you know, I pay for the good seats, and I say, can you hold them? They say, yeah. And so I'm like right there in front of them, but they've blurbed me. They've blurbed my reviews. And for one of the albums, I believe it was Fallen Angels. It's like, so-and-so from the New York Times, so-and-so from the Guardian, Vish Khanna for Now Magazine says 5 stars or whatever I said. I'm like, I know this is like a little minor thing, but I'm like,
except for it isn't.
Yes.
First of all, it wouldn't be, even if you weren't a huge Bob Dylan fan, it would still be a big deal for someone of his stature to say, Vish Khanna, this is a blurb that this man has this done.
I think it's a little testament to something. Like I can't, it's bizarre. Like I feel, and they blurbed, I wrote a review of the latest bootleg series thing there, Springtime in New York. And they blurred that too. Like they grab, you know, they grab all the critics' assessments. They posted my review of his album Tempest on their website. And I was just like, I feel seen.
You feel seen. Your life is weird. That's one of those things where you're like, I like you so much. You know who I am?
That's where I'm coming from. And I don't think he knows who I am, but
he might.
When I write to his camp and I say, I have this idea, they say, okay, well, we're talking to Bob next week. We'll bring this up. I'm like, holy Lord. Like the fact that they would even, you know, often it's not just about me. It's about whatever entity I'm representing, but wow. So he seems plugged in and I feel very deeply connected to him. Your question or your thought was about Blowing in the Wind, and I feel like I knocked us off course. What were you going to say about Blowing in the Wind?
Well, here's something you should know is that we have about 10 more minutes, You've been one of my favorite guests in the way that it's plug and play. And it's just like, oh, what do you want to talk about? Oh, and then 50 minutes of Vishkana talking of about Bob Dylan.
Sorry, so, was that okay? Have I gone on too
long? It is the best.
Okay,
great. It is the best. I thoroughly enjoy it. The only thing that would ruin it is if you never stop talking about it. And then I had to say, hey, I'm going to stop recording it.
Well, as a fellow podcaster, this is me on
that
the
That would
other
not happen. It's a, I feel, exactly.
I feel like I can be a little verbose, but yes,
You're doing the job. Yeah, yeah.
I love him and his work, and I've thought about it a lot. So I appreciate you letting me talk about it. But yeah.
Here is something I usually do when it comes to musical dorkdoms, when I don't know anything about the musician or I don't know enough about the musician. I like to sort of, and you've had no warning.
Yes.
So If you could do it over the next couple of days, because this will go up in a week, to make sort of a playlist of 8 of your favorite songs.
Okay.
Just 8. Because
what format do you want? What service are we using to make this playlist?
Well, most people use Spotify, but since Spotify has taken all of my albums off of Spotify, because I asked for 8 cents instead of 4/400ths of a cent every time they play a joke of mine on Spotify. So I'm part of some sort of, it might be a class, I don't know what you would call it, but some sort of a bunch of people saying, hey, could you play stand-up comedy and pay us like musicians? They're like, oh, we're just going to take your comedy off.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully, I don't care. This could hurt me. I hate them. I don't know if you notice it when
what
I
do
tweeted,
usually. Yeah.
Well, I'm an Apple person, so I just got Apple. I'm not saying any of them are very good. First of all, again, you can see my shelf here, can't you?
It turns out you have a CD player player.
No, these are records. Yeah, I don't have I have like 1,800 CDs in the basement that I brought here from Ontario.
Yeah.
But, or 2,000 maybe it is. But I actually currently do not have an active CD player. I only have my Toyota 2020 Toyota Sienna has a CD player in it.
Okay.
That's it. But no, I have records and I play them on my record player. But when I tweeted about your appearance on my show, I don't know if you noticed this. Graciously retweeted it, but I include options for people to listen. And I always, because they're the biggest ones, I include Apple, Google, which I don't actually know if that is very big, and then Spotify. But if you'll notice, I do, to save space, I just did little symbols. So for the Apple, I use an Apple emoji. For Google, I use a magnifying glass because you search on Google. That was my joke. But then for Spotify, it's a little devil emoji because I begrudgingly am including it because I think they're evil. And the fact that they did that to you and other comedians is heinous, reprehensible. Yep. I hate them. I don't use it. I only use it for business purposes. But for listening,
you could make a YouTube list.
Oh, I could do that. Sure, I'll do whatever you want. If it's easier
offhand,
for people on Spotify, I don't care. I'm just saying I don't like them, but I can use whatever.
Yeah,
you
want. Yeah, right. And fair enough. But for these last couple of minutes, could you think of and you can change it when you send me the mix, but what are some of your favorite songs?
Okay, so there's a version. Yeah, I will think about it, but I will also say off the top of my head, I mentioned this record, Time Out of Mind.
Right.
So I mentioned 2 songs off it that I love. Obviously, I sing them to my kids, but I'm going to go with Cold Iron's Bound from Time Out of Mind.
Okay.
I'm going to go with probably Mississippi from Love and Theft. Although I'm partial to other really great songs on that record. That's a 2001 one.
Okay.
I'm going to go with As I Went Out One Morning from John Wesley Harding.
Okay.
I'm going to go with Million Dollar Bash, which my daughter actually requested that last night. That's from The Basement Tapes, his work with the band.
Okay.
I'm going to go with, this is harder than I thought. From Live 1966, maybe Tell Me Mama. Sorry, I'm not looking at you. I'm looking at my collection of music.
No, you have to look deeply into the bowels of your vinyl collection.
Yeah, yes. Sorry. I'm just looking through all the eras, and I will go with One More Cup of Coffee from Desire.
Okay.
How many songs are we at right now?
I think we're at 6.
Okay. Then I will go with Maybe.
I have to tell you, I think I've heard of two of them.
Well, that's fine.
He's super prolific, too.
Let's just go back in time to the point where you asked me if he was in the Rolling Stones. Like, this is the level of expertise.
I knew that he wasn't in the Rolling Stones. I thought that he wrote a song about Rolling Stones.
He has collaborated with the Rolling Stones.
Okay.
In live, I mean.
And I did ask if he was still alive.
Yeah, that's so also not great. Not
a
great
nod.
Look.
It's not a great look.
I'm going to go with If Not For You, which he wrote with George Harrison.
Oh, okay.
He's on his album New Morning. And just to throw a, I'm going to go with Tweeter and the Monkey Man by the Traveling Wilburys. Do you remember the Traveling Wilburys?
I've heard of them, yes.
The Traveling Wilburys. This is fine. I hope I don't come across snooty or snotty by saying.
Oh, not at all.
Okay. So Traveling Wilburys was like a super group that formed in like 87, 88. And right. It was kind of a lark, but it was George Harrison from the Beatles, Roy Orbison from Roy Orbison, Jeff Lynne from Electric Light Orchestra, Tom Petty from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and Bob Dylan from Bob Dylan. And they had a band. It was just like a lark, but they all wrote songs together. They had that Handle With Care.
That's right.
And End of the Line were some big singles.
Yeah.
But Dylan wrote this amazing song called Tweeter and the Monkey Man. Mm-hmm. And it's got a lot of New Jersey allusions, some allusions to Bruce Springsteen that are really funny.
Okay.
So I'm go with that one. So I think we're at close to 8.
That looks good. Yeah, that sounds amazing.
I Contain Multitudes, maybe from the new album, Rough and Rowdy Ways. Sorry, it's there's so much to choose from. This is all off the top of my head.
That's it. And off the top of your head is the way it ought to be, because people who love Bob Dylan, who are listening to this, are like, I'm so glad he mentioned a lot of these deep cuts, you know?
Yeah.
And that book. So have you read a lot of biographies about him
I've read a lot of Bob Dylan books. I can't show it to you because my computer's stationary, but there's a 2 or 3 shelves of just Bob Dylan books.
Oh, wow.
I've had people who've written about Bob Dylan on the show. Greil Marcus, notably, who has famously written about Dylan. So I've read a lot. I've watched a lot. I said earlier, like, sometimes it doesn't feel like enough. Like when you're talking to like a super obsessed Dylan fan, they'll say something, and I am, I think, but then they'll say something about the coffee he drank in Israel. And I'm like, oh yeah, the symbolism of that. I forgot about that. Like, I just forget things because my brain is, I have children and I have the information I used to.
Right.
I remember earlier, sometimes I think I know a year.
Yeah.
And then I only recently discovered that the year I thought it was for like 30 years is not right. And I pride myself on my memory. So,
but here's the real question. Was the coffee that he drank in Israel, did it matter?
I'm just, that was a random example.
Okay.
The thing, he's one of these people where people look for meaning in every single thing he says and does.
Right.
And
that feels like either he's playing them or they're playing themselves, because I mean, as important an artist as he is, I love the lyrics. I have a hard time understanding the lyrics when he's singing just because of his enunciation. But I love the covers. When somebody else does a Bob Dylan song, I'm like, listen to those lyrics.
So
those
that's
are
interesting.
Great.
Yeah. So some people have a thing about his voice, but what I was trying to argue earlier is he clearly can sing anything he wants.
Mm-hmm.
He's shown it. Like, he's had a different voice.
With albums, they often put the lyrics in the liner notes.
Yeah, they do. And I you can see them all. Every single song he's ever written is on bobdylan.com.
Yeah.
You can read them all if you want, and they come across well on the page. For me, as a singer, his approach to phrasing is like nobody else, really. It comes from listening to people like Sinatra and the great crooners. Like, I sing a line to my daughter in Standing in the Doorway all the time. And I'm going to biff it right now, but it's because it's one of those things where if I know the whole verse, I can do it.
Yeah.
But he basically says something like, yesterday, everything was moving too fast. Today, it's moving too slow. And he sings the fast part super fast. And he sings the slow part really labored. And so he gives this character to these lines.
Right.
Where it's almost meta. He's a very clever singer. And
right.
When he dials down on a line or two, he really gives them everything he can in the moment. It gives them this rich character, which I appreciate as well. So all this to say, I think, I hope I put sort of the bug in your ear. to go
you
check
really
in?
Did okay. Vish, this has been a fascinating hour of about an artist that I have always enjoyed in passing. And so this sort of deep dive into it is, I love it. I love a dork out where it's not. And yeah, I got information, but I also got some fun stories and a sort of a new glimpse into the guy himself. Yeah. So Rangers, we're listening here to Vish Khanna. Let's get it right. Vish Khanna. And the name of your podcast is Creative Control. There are two K's because of some lyric, because of some song. What is it?
Yeah, there's a song by a band called Hot Snakes that I copped the title from the show from and was using their theme music with quasi permission.
Okay.
But I don't use it very much anymore. I often just use a little bed track from the artist I'm talking to, but I don't know if you know, you wouldn't have noticed this, Jackie, but that song by Hot Snakes, Creative Control, was featured on your episode because you didn't have any music I could use.
Right, so, right. There's no music. And so yeah. There's just Mike Rickberg singing the Dork Forest theme song that you will
That's
hear.
True. That's
and,
true.
But it's at Vish Khanna, but Vish is spelled V-I-S-H and Khanna is spelled K-H-A-N-N-A. It'll be in the notes. I just did Vish's podcast. You could do a little crossover if you like. Thanks so much for doing the show, Vish.
Absolute pleasure, Jackie. Thank you so much for asking me. It really is an honor. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?